Them changes from lead exposure may seem odd to associate lead toxicity with health issues, cardiac health issues. But there have been considerable research put into the association. Health experts seem to agree there is no safe level of lead in the bodies. And this heavy metal toxin is not easily flushed out of the system. Though small amounts can collect and accrue in vital organs, especially in the kidneys and the liver. Juicing celery, superfood that can repair the digestive system and detoxify. About $1.50 a day in celery juice can boost your diet with essential vitamins and minerals while helping to improve a long list of ailments, including digestive disorders, high blood pressure, arthritis, inflammation, autoimmune disorders, anemia, asthma, skin problems, and more. Yes, I was up at 4:30 this morning. I have been able to back off my time a little bit, getting more organized, and I got a different juicer. And was doing my celery. I also got some dandelion greens. There's a new store in Columbia, Missouri called Lucky's that has incredible organic produce. I hope to never have to go to Deerberg's again. They put out some really lousy produce. I haven't even told Josh about this. And then expected me to pay full price for it. And I said, well, why don't you knock off some of the money? And they said, that's fine. Those berries that were half rotten were fine. I said, are you kidding me? The strawberries that had no sheen to them, that were all matte color. And all I said was, I'll use them today if you'll give them to me for half price. Nope, absolutely not. So I said, well, I probably will never be in this store again. He says, that's fine. That was Deerberg's. Just want to let you know, that was the manager of the entire store. So Deerberg's and I got a divorce, ladies and gentlemen. If you go to Deerberg's store, you know, they're not very good about, making sure that all the produce looks good. Now, a lot of it does. They have a lot of excellent produce. But the very fact that they cannot take down the price just a little bit when it's halfway gone, that's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. Did you know that USDA has now added fresh produce, yogurt, and tofu to the food voucher for poor program for the first change in 34 years? Did you know you couldn't get produce and the food voucher program? Unbelievable. We'll be back after this 3-minute break. Then in the next hour, James Corbett's going to join us. We want to know what's happening in the financial sector as well as his thoughts on Ukraine. Stay tuned. We'll be back. 3-minute break. This is George Riley and the Power Hour. Getting back to the news, there are a lot of people that are talking about a collapse of the economy. Now, the date that has been picked is interesting, and I'm going to ask our guest coming up in this next hour, James Corbett, what his thoughts are. The date, are you ready for this? March 4th. That's tomorrow, March 4th. And why are so many people talking about this? We'll find out from our guest in this next hour. I want to know, too. I want to know, I've heard it from so many different sources. Why is it they're picking March 4th? With all the banker suicides, warnings from banks that the stock market is about to decline by 10% or more, to add to that, remember the article that appeared in the Washington Times back in October said U.S. economy on schedule for crash, March 4th, 2014. Now, things are getting really strange, and a lot of people are starting to wonder what this is all about. According to the economic world as we know it would collapse entirely around the coming Tuesday, a day which some have pointed out is in fact a Tuesday, just like Black Tuesday, on the day that Wall Street crashed in 1929, which led the country into the Great Depression. Now, that was according to the Washington Times. Washington Times wasn't the only one either. Back in 2010, the Mail Online ran a story after Cambridge professor said that based on history, a cataclysmic event of international significance would rock the world in 2014. In the last 500 years, there's been a cataclysmic great event of international significance at the start of each century, occurring in the middle of the second decade of each century. They include events which sparked, you know, religious conflict, all kinds of conflict, going back to World War One in 1914, remember? And by the way, they were mentioning this on Fox yesterday. The First World War broke out, a catastrophic conflict that would claim millions of lives and set the tone for international discord throughout the 21st century. So, is there something big happening? More recently, renowned trends forecaster Gerald Celente predicted that the world's economies will begin to spiral into a death spin this spring as well, although he isn't certain of the specific date. People the world over are sick and tired of their corrupt governments. And here in America, we are a much poorer nation than people realize. Nearly half the requests of emergency assistance to stave off hunger or homelessness come from people with full-time jobs. Wow, that is a shocker. If you make more than $10,000, you earn more than 24% of the Americans. If you make $15,000, you make more than 32% of the Americans. If you make $30,000, you make more than half of all Americans, ladies and gentlemen. That is amazing. And unfortunate. And who makes all the money? And where does it go? We'll be back after this 1 minute, 10 second break. Stay tuned to the Power Hour. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. It is 8 minutes after the hour, wherever you're sitting. It is not looking good financially, what's happening across the board, pretty much with the European stocks, the DAX, the CAC, the DAX, CAC, the Nikkei, all down. And, of course, getting ready to open the bottom of this hour, we've got the Dow futures down about 127 points, and gold is up a little bit. We are talking with James Corbett this hour, a absolute favorite of the Power Hour. James is the one that we go to for financial news and any other news. CorbettReport.com, and there's two T's there. CorbettReport.com. He has an independent listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open source intelligence. He provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos. And I know he has a breaking one coming out the end of this week on the Federal Reserve. I hope we can talk about here. And he's been living and working in Japan since 2004. He writes for the International Forecaster and the CorbettReport.com. Thank you so much, James, for joining us in the Power Hour today.
Well, thank you, as always, for having me here. And there's so much going on, so it's great to be able to talk to you and your audience about what's happening right now.
Well, thank you. You know, to me, James, whenever we're able to do this, you know, be on the air and talk like this, it's kind of like a giant catharsis, you know? We're able to just let go of so much that we've been thinking and feeling about instead of keeping it in our minds, because I know your mind is probably like mine. You're just constantly running and thinking and trying to imagine what this means. If that means that, then this means this and where we go from here. But if I were to ask you what it is that is your biggest issue right now that you think is beyond important of everything else, what would that be?
Well, you are exactly right. I mean, there are hundreds of things dancing through my mind at the best of times. And at times like these, it's just all I can do to try to keep up with the news as it's flowing out. But I'd have to say, if there's one issue that we're staring right in the face of right now that I think is exceptionally important, it has to be the events that are unfolding in Ukraine right now, because, of course, this is, if not the the run-up to World War III, I mean, that might be overblown at this point, but certainly we are seeing the most sharp divisions along geopolitical fault lines that we've seen, I think, in the last couple of decades. And we really are staring at a type of process that could be, again, we're sitting here on the centenary of 1914, the beginning of World War I, where all of these types of agreements and understandings between various governments basically drew the entire industrialized world into one giant war. And we are staring into the face a similar type of situation. And I'm not saying it's necessarily going to happen, and I'm not saying that Ukraine is going to be the spark for this, but it certainly is worrying. And combine that with all of the various economic worries that we have, and you really do have a potential spark for something much greater to unfold here. So I'm definitely on the edge of my seat watching really minute by minute as this continues to develop.
Let's talk about Putin's move into the Crimea area and into the Black Sea to protect his Black Sea fleet. Your thoughts on whether or not he has invaded and created a problem that is probably immeasurable, as far as John Kerry would say, is, you know, how bad it can be, given the fact that he had no pretext to do it. Of course, forgetting all about the pretext that we had, the phony pretext that we had with Iraq and Afghanistan. What are your thoughts about the move that Putin made into Crimea?
Well, it is exceptionally tempting to try to put this either as a, well, the U.S. is right to condemn him for this, or Putin is right to do it. And I don't know if I want to step into that binary thinking. It's either one or the other, because I think that perhaps in this conflict, both sides are in the wrong, or at least are not in the right. We can, I think, safely put it that way. As with any of these types of issues, I think that ultimately this has to come down to the Ukrainian people themselves to decide what is going to happen to their own country. And so outside interference of any sort is always, I think, to be discouraged. But having said that, of course, we know that there has been a concerted, coordinated effort for literally at least a decade now to undermine any sort of democratic tendency in Ukraine that's been supported openly by the State Department and others. In fact, Victoria Nuland, of course, the Assistant Secretary of State, who is most famous for having said a very naughty word about the EU in a leaked phone call recently, she has also been discovered on tape just a year or so ago talking about how the U.S. State Department has invested $5 billion over the past several years, $5 billion in developing democratic institutions in the Ukraine. And of course, I think we all understand what that really means. And I think the last example of that was the 2004 revolution, the Orange Revolution that swept through Kiev in a remarkably similar event to what we've seen take place this year.
Yes.
So we know that this is a coordinated agenda, and it's been going on for a long time. So to say that to necessarily condemn Putin for stepping in and coming to the aid of ethnic Russians in the Crimea area, which used to be part of Russia until 1954, to condemn him for that would be difficult to do, because it does seem like a pretty logical move on his part. At any rate, I think some of the way that the reaction to this is taking place is very interesting, including a G8 suspension of Russia, and Kerry, I think, was openly flirting with the idea of kicking Russia out of the G8. That's a pretty dramatic move. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show just how close we are to the brink of absolute open military confrontation between two, well, if not superpowers, at least one superpower and one former superpower, which still could be very interesting.
You know, the comments of John Kerry, I think, are just amazing. He said, "You just don't invade another country on a phony pretext in order to assert your interests." I mean, how hypocritical can one man be? I mean, if anybody had any kind of phony pretext, I mean, we own phony pretext in the United States for invading all these countries. So, but it appears to me, though, that if in fact, now, if you were a leader of a country and you had a naval fleet in the Black Sea area and you wanted to protect that naval fleet and the country was in a time of turmoil, and you wanted to protect your only major naval fleet, would you not go in there to the Crimean area and say, okay, guys, you know, let's calm down here because we have some problems? There's not been a shot fired, we're told. He's just simply trying to protect his fleet. Is that not his right to do that?
Well, certainly when there are military bases involved, there's going to be complications. And this is, I think, isn't it interesting that the other major conflict that we've seen in recent years has been Syria, where, of course, there's also a major Russian naval base. And so direct Russian military stake in what's happening. And again, just like in Syria, where the opposition was being funded and fostered and equipped and trained and put into motion by the U.S. and various other allies over the past several years, again, here in Ukraine, we have a similar situation, and this has to be seen as part of a larger plan of encirclement and provocation against Russia over the past decade, at the very least. And we could put this back to the color revolutions that were sweeping across the former Soviet republics a decade ago, including Georgia, including Ukraine, of course, in former Yugoslavia, where all of this was really cemented in the first place, this color revolution script. And they're still using it. And so I think, again, Putin is not insane to think of this as a direct threat to Russia, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's a lot of nuance to this. And I don't don't simply want to praise Putin for what's happening here, because I think that would be too simplistic. But again, to condemn him for trying to protect actual naval and military assets is very difficult to do.
Am I over the edge on this, or could this possibly be a situation? Because we're watching what's happening, the pandering back and forth. Because, you know, we're told that the President of the United States had a 45-minute conversation with Putin. Well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know, because I don't believe anything that's really coming out of the White House. But could it not be a situation that ultimately ends in, okay, you get Crimea and we get Syria, or we can do what we choose to do with Syria?
I suppose that would be an arrangement that would be within the realm of possibility. I don't know if that arrangement would be probable. Certainly, Russia has more at stake, I think, in what happens in Ukraine than it does in Syria. I mean, other than the naval base, I don't think they have a lot of direct stake in Syria. But they certainly do right in their backyard in Ukraine. So I think that type of offer would at least give you sort of an incentive because, well, at least we get to keep sort of our territory in our backyard. But I really don't think that Putin would back down on that issue so quickly, so easily. And especially when I think, from Putin's perspective, at any rate, he's being aggressed upon. Russian interests are being aggressed upon in both incidents. So why would he give up on one of them in order to get the other? That would sort of indicate that he'd be willing to acquiesce if they pushed somewhere else. Then maybe he'd give up on Crimea or something like that. So I don't know if that would make diplomatic sense from his viewpoint. But certainly I think there is going to be some significant diplomatic wheeling and dealing in the next several days. And so much hinges on whether or not there can be a face-saving sort of deal at this stage of the game.
Yeah, I think it's, well, if you were watching American television over the weekend and you heard CNN saying, you know, talking about how the president's doing everything he can, but there's only so much that our president can do and standing by the president. And then if you're watching Fox News, it was all about, do you think Hillary will run? I mean, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that all of Saturday was on will Hillary run, while CNN is flying their, you know, breaking news banner every 2.5 minutes, which there was no breaking news. They just flew the banner because, you know, that makes people want to watch because they think there's breaking news. But the media is using this, but everybody is sort of negotiating toward the same thing, and that is, well, we can't use military force. I mean, both networks are saying that. Well, it's obvious we cannot use military force. And I don't know if that's to try and put down any kind of unrest among the American people or fear or whatever. But at the same time, it just is amazing how the media is covering this. We've got a four-minute break. We will be back with our James Corbett financial and everything else review. He knows everything, it seems like. We'll be back after this four-minute break. Stay tuned to the Power Hour, CorbettReport.com. Check it out, C-O-R-B-E-T-T Report.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Joyce Riley. So we're talking to James Corbett today, and he is such a well-known reporter. He does writing. He is narrative on so many things that are happening. And we're talking to him about Ukraine today. And we'll take some phone calls in the next hour on that subject also. We'll just take some caller phone calls in the next hour because I do want you to be able to have a chance to say what you are thinking about this. But the question about where this is going is what everybody's asking. Where are we headed now? I mean, it's considered an actual invasion now. So he has, in fact, invaded another country. And then the United States says that, you know, you can't use phony pretext to do it. But like I said, you know, we trademarked the phony pretext issue in going into countries to start a war for no reason. What about the idea that the United States has been creating this scenario and situation in the Ukraine and has pretty much been kind of waiting for this to happen, James?
Well, I think there's no doubt, again, that they have been creating this behind the scenes for many years. And the question is only whether or not it's going according to plan, whether they have the type of pull and power and influence over the nascent acting interim government as they had hoped. And I've just in the last hour or so, posted a new video up to Global Research TV, grtv.ca, on this situation and what's really brought us to this point. And it's interesting, in that video I cite a 2000 2004 incident that took place in March in 2004 in Kiev, where George Soros was attending a conference that was happening at the time about fair elections in the country. And this was several months before the Orange Revolution that that swept the country and as we all know, by this point, took Yanukovych, took the election away from Yanukovych and gave it to Yushchenko, and we all know how that turned out eventually. But at the time, in March of 2004, of course, none of this had occurred yet, and yet, during that conference, there were protesters who came and they shouted something to the effect of, Soros, get out of Ukraine, we don't want you interfering. And they doused him with glue and water. And there's a very tiny thumbnail image on BBC News that you can download of that incident of Soros being doused by these protesters in this heckling move. And that's a pretty interesting and telling moment, because of course this was even before it eventually took place. And who was the one or one of the people who were implicated in this after the Orange Revolution came? It was Soros and his Open Society Institute. And that comes from I mean, even The Guardian, which may be called a left-leaning outlet, but certainly isn't a conspiracy alternative media type outlet. And even they, during the course of that Orange Revolution, were saying that it traces back to the U.S. aid, the National Endowment for Democracy, George Soros's Open Society Institute, and other institutions like that. So this has been known about for a long time, that these various NGOs have been operating in Kiev, in Ukraine generally, fomenting this type of action for many years now. And in fact, even you can look at some of the recent documents that have come out to show that the types of, literally the types of pamphlets that these protesters were getting on what to wear and what to pack in their backpacks when going to these types of rallies, etc., is literally the exact same image as what was given a couple of in Egypt, to the protesters there. And literally all that's changed is the translation. You can actually see images of these various pamphlets. How does that happen? How do they have the exactly identical types of literature? It's because it's the same people behind it. And this traces back to various organizations, like one that was called Otpor, that originally came out of Yugoslavia and during the time of that breakup. And that's where this kind of template was formed. It eventually morphed into something called Canvas, but it's a lot of the same characters behind it. And they've been implicated in the Egyptian revolution, in what's happening in Ukraine, and various other places. So this is a template. It's been used before. We know interference has happened. The only question is, how much power does, for example, the U.S. State Department have right now to call the shots of who's in and who's out of the new government? And obviously, given that leaked phone call from Victoria Nuland recently, they at least believe that they are able to say who's in and who's out, regardless of what the EU might want. So I think things are probably, we're going according to plan. It's always a question, though, about the eastern part of the country, which is more ethnically Russian, where there's a greater propensity of people who cite Russian is their native language. That's really the wild card here, and of course now that's where this flashpoint is taking place. So it's very interesting.
We'll probably see those pamphlets for people in Mali, Sudanese people, and Nigeria. They'll be just making more and more pamphlets for more and more people to follow. We'll be back after this 3-minute break with James Corbett. Check out CorbettReport.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We've been talking about the situation, of course, that everybody's focusing on in the Ukraine. But there's information that while the world's focus is on the Ukraine, or like in some places on the Oscars last night of all things, which got almost no attention. Nobody's watching it. Nobody cares. It's important that we realize that the Middle East tensions are still mounting. And while the international community is looking at Ukraine, the Middle Eastern cauldron is continuing to bubble, and we need to continue to look at that. And so Allison Weir will join us in this next hour, ifamericansknew.com. ifamericansknew.com is her website. A lot happening in the Middle Eastern area. Is there anything you want to add regarding the Middle East before we move on to other things, James?
Not the Middle East specifically, but North Africa. If you want to take a look at Libya, it gives the lie to this whole idea of what is really being accomplished in these maneuvers, where people, I'm sure many people have genuine responses to the suffering that they see in various places, and they think they want to help, and, oh, we should be doing something. And that's generally the type of rhetoric you'll hear from people who, for example, support U.S. intervention in what's happening in Ukraine right now. Oh, these Ukrainian people are being oppressed by this terrible Yanukovych. We need to go in and help. But if there's anything that gives a lie to it, it is Libya, which, of course, continues to just be a complete basket case, really, as things continue to fall apart there. And it's interesting, again, just a few years ago, everyone was so concerned about what was happening under Gaddafi, and, oh, was he killing his own people, and what was happening, and, oh, we have to go in and do something about it. But, of course, no one at all is talking about Libya anymore. And just yesterday, we had something come out from BBC indicating Libya MPs shot and wounded as Congress stormed. So, again, they're still in the midst of really civil war. I mean, it's a country in name only at this point, and is not really being effectively ruled at all from Tripoli. So that country just continues to fall apart at the seams, even as, again, the attention is just focused on another area, and people will continue to care about that for as long as they're told to care about that by the media and the politicians who are puppeteering them.
And, of course, the streets are filled in Venezuela with people that are upset about what's happening down there. Or we're told that they want Maduro out, which, you know, I think is the U.S. Slant on that story. But let me go back to Libya for just a second. Have you interviewed the Moriartys on your program or for your videos?
I have not, no.
They are amazing. They live there, and they have contacts. And we have had four or five people on from Libya, directly from Libya, and also from Syria, that they have been able to get us in contact with to tell us what's really taking place over there. So if you're interested, I can get you in contact with them, because those people really know what is happening in Libya. Let me move on to Mt. Gox, because a lot of people have been interested. I know JD was interested in what your take is on Mt. Gox and the Bitcoin now that they have declared bankruptcy. Is that going to affect forever the Bitcoin or not?
Well, maybe and maybe not. I hate to always give these kind of halfway answers, but
we're seeing a trend here, by the way. We're seeing a trend.
Well, I think the point about what happened with Mt. Gox is that this was not fundamentally to do with Bitcoin as Bitcoin. This wasn't really a problem with the Bitcoin protocol, with what Bitcoin actually is. It was a problem with this particular exchange. And it's a pretty important problem because, in fact, this was at one point the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world and was still quite a massive one. And what has happened is 750,000 Bitcoins, which is equivalent to 7% of all the Bitcoins that have been mined, has gone missing from Mt. Gox and caused the collapse of that exchange. And that's, I mean, obviously, that's a huge, huge event. And it's not one that was completely unforeseeable. In fact, people have been talking for years about some of the problems with Mt. Gox, and some of the, I think, Bitcoin diehards and people who really follow Bitcoin have known about Mt. Gox's problems for some time, although maybe not known to that extent, that the problem was quite that big. And so basically the Bitcoin proponents will be saying, well, look, this is actually a sign that Bitcoin is bigger and more flexible than people think, because, again, this was just one exchange, and it would be like saying, as one analyst said, it would be like saying if Gmail suddenly went under for some reason, we wouldn't say that email no longer works, or something like that. I mean, it's just one particular outlet, and in fact, the Bitcoin price averaged over all the remaining indexes and exchanges has pretty much stabilized, even gone up a little bit since this point. So it is not a mortal blow to Bitcoin itself as Bitcoin, but on the other side of that coin, to use that phrase, we have the public perception of Bitcoin, and maybe this has been, if not a mortal blow, at least a very serious blow to that public perception, because a public that was already very incredulous about what is this Bitcoin, how does it work, it's just bits and bytes on a computer screen, what is that, that's not money to me, those people obviously are not going to be won over by an event like this, and they're probably only going to read the headlines and think, well, that's Bitcoin for you. So I think that the damage to the sort of PR damage to Bitcoin is probably of a much greater consequence than this one particular exchange.
But it seems to me that you're talking about public perception, but undermining consumer confidence is half of what it's all about, it seems like to me. And that has been...
Yeah, no, that's very true. In fact, with any currency, I mean, a currency is only as good as people's belief in it, because at the end of the day, I mean, even if you're talking about gold or silver or what have you, people still have to desire that commodity in order for it to be valuable, in order for it to be seen as a store of value, in order for it to be used as money. I mean, there's a lot of links in that chain of assumptions, and when you're talking about physical commodities like gold and silver that have been used for thousands of years, you might be on fairly safe footing with that assumption. But still, I mean, and especially when we look at the fiat dollars that are in most people's wallets right now, again, that's just based on the assumption that people will value it, that there will be a system around that will accept those pieces of paper, and that they do have that type of exchange value. So again, a currency really is only as good as people's opinion of it. And people's opinion of Bitcoin certainly has not gone up on this. And all it means is that for a currency that was already very difficult for the average person to get involved in, I mean, most people still don't really even understand what Bitcoin are, let alone how to get them. It's only going to be that much more difficult, really, from this point, because now you have to think about even what exchanges you use and where you, if you keep your money on the exchange or if you keep it locally and blah, blah, blah. There's more things to think about, because otherwise your Bitcoins can just, quote unquote, disappear. And we still don't quite even understand how this happened. They've been very vague on talking about this. The chief executive was just talking in front of a Japanese government panel in a bankruptcy filing case. And he's just saying things like there was some weakness in the system and the Bitcoins have disappeared.
Yeah.
It sounds like very shady practices. And I'm sure there's been some sort of dishonesty and pilfering going on at some level, whether that was internal and inside job or whether someone had hacked in or what it is, I don't think we know yet. But it just goes to show that, again, I mean, you have to be even more vigilant than people already kind of have to be in order to get involved with Bitcoin. So yes, I think this is a significant thing. I wouldn't dismiss this. But again, it's not a problem with Bitcoin itself. It's just a problem with the way that it's handled, we'll say.
Kind of reminds me of the mismanagement at the Pentagon. They had a little mismanagement problem and lost, $8 trillion or $8 billion?
$8.5 trillion and counting, yeah.
Yeah, little mismanagement problem, sure. Anyway, let's move on to, you said that you wanted to talk about what happened in China. And I need to know, what is the story behind that and why that murder case, that stabbing attack situation is so important in your mind?
Yeah, well, it is it's a bizarre story. I mean, for one thing, and for people who weren't following it, basically there was the Kunming railway station in Kunming, which is the capital of Yunnan province in the southwest of China, was the scene of a really bizarre attack where, quote, more than 10 terrorist suspects. So we don't even know at this point how many people were involved, but more than 10 terrorist suspects started attacking people with knives at the square in front of the station and in the ticket hall, and ended up killing a confirmed 29 civilians, and 143 have been injured. Just a massive carnage that took place there, just a bizarre event. I mean, anywhere you go, but I think all obviously in China, although the rest of Western provinces where the Uyghur, the ethnic Uyghurs are, which is a type of Muslim that is not part of the Han Chinese, but they're actually part of China. That's where the sort of terrorist incidents in the past have generally been located. But an interesting event took place early this year. I think it was in the first week of the year or somewhere around then, where there was an attack at just outside the entrance to the Forbidden City, which is just across the street from the Tiananmen Square in Beijing, where a car actually just ran into a bunch of people who were standing outside of the Forbidden City waiting to get in. And that was an interesting thing, because at first it was being reported as if it was an accident, but eventually they came out and said, no, this was a terrorist attack. So now we're starting to see terrorist attacks in Beijing, in Yunnan province, in places that are very far removed from Xinjiang, which is where the Uyghurs are, which goes to show that this is becoming, perhaps, China's terrorist problem. And really, what is this all about? What's really all behind this? Well, for anyone who has listened to my interview series on Operation Gladio B, which is up on CorbettReport.com right now, you'll know that this relates back to the types of outside interference that basically NATO and the U.S. government, the Pentagon, have been running in Central Asia for the last several years now, since at least 1996, 1997, where basically they're funding and training and sending over people to equip and otherwise enable Muslim terrorists in Central Asia as part of getting their claws into that region of the globe and destabilizing China and Russia, because that region is really on both of their doorsteps. So this, I think, has to be seen in that context, especially since we know that the terrorist incidents in Xinjiang do tie back to that Operation Gladio B. So this is all very interesting for me to watch. I know this is not really on the radar of a lot of people out there, because this region just isn't reported on a lot and these types of events. But I guarantee in the coming years, this region and these types of events will become more important. I don't know if they'll be more reported on, but they will be more important as part of the sort of general encirclement of China and Russia. And I think people should be taking a look at this, and I'm certainly going to be taking a look at the Chinese outlets and how they're reporting on this terrorist attack, and then seeing what else I can dig up on it, so I might be able to report more on it for you next time.
Excellent, excellent. We appreciate that. And also your work, excellent work at GR, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to see his videos, post at grtv.ca. grtv.ca. Let's go to Fukushima, because we didn't cover that the last time you were on the show, and a lot of people wanted to know. It seems like we have more and more mistakes coming out, and oops, we are so stupid, and we didn't notice that, and oh my goodness, we do have a problem now. What are you hearing in Japan, since you're there? What are you hearing about Fukushima?
Well, some of the main stories that are happening right now include the ever-present problem of storage for waste that's being produced at the site. That's an ongoing problem, and one that we've known about for a long time, but it continues to be a problem because, of course, with all of the waste water that's being pumped through there and being stored on site, they are physically running out of space. And the Japanese government has been in negotiations trying to see if there are other places around the country that will try to keep this in their backyard, where we'll bury it in the ground for the next 100,000 years or so until it becomes inert. But oddly enough, there doesn't seem to be any municipalities that are willing to do that. So this is an ongoing point of deliberation, and some of the stories on FukushimaUpdate.com right now reflect that. Another interesting development, Japan finally acquiesces to U.S. request to return weapons-grade plutonium, and this is in regards to the now 331 kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium that Japan was in possession of as of 2012. Despite the fact that, of course, this is not a nuclear weapons nation, it's only a nuclear reactor nation. But of course, we all know that the nuclear reactors are really just a cover for the ability to create nuclear weapons, and it could be flipped on the dime. And Japan already has hundreds of kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium in a secret program that was kept from the public for decades, that goes back to the 1960s, between the U.S. and the U.K., both providing weapons-grade plutonium to this country. That's a pretty major scandal in a country that likes to think of itself as a non-nuclear nation. And so now this is kind of coming out in the context of all of the other nuclear news that's coming out of Japan, along with the elections in Tokyo, which recently put in a governor that's favorable to nuclear power, which became sort of a wedge issue among the electorate in that campaign. And on the heels of that, the Japanese government has just unveiled a new draft energy policy, which, surprise, surprise, says that nuclear power will remain an important source of electricity for the country. So in a 180-degree turn from the last administration that was voted out last December, which was saying they were going to go to zero nuclear power by the middle of the century, we now have this new Abe administration saying they're going to go even more gung-ho with starting up reactors. So it just continues to unfold in a nuclear nightmare here.
A nuclear nightmare is right. When we come back, we're going to be talking to James Corbett about the Federal Reserve. He's doing a new release on a documentary this Friday. So we'll be talking Federal Reserve when we get back. Stay tuned. This is Joyce Riley and James Corbett. We'll be right back. 3 minutes. Four minutes after the hour. Thank you so much. Wherever you're sitting, we appreciate you joining the Power Hour today. James Corbett is our guest. And I got to tell you, James, there are a lot of people in this country that are not so happy with Japan because allegedly, according to the propane distributors that we have talked to, the propane is going to China and Japan from the United States. Thus, we have the price increase because they're having to go. I know from Missouri, they had to go all the way to western Kansas to get propane, not making us so happy to have our propane prices double here, and saying that it's going to Japan because they're sort of underwriting the decrease in nuclear power. Secondary to Fukushima was the answer that they were given. Also, I just want to bring up that the problem with Russia may bring another problem. Problem with Russian ammo, which a lot of people are documenting on the internet about how Wolf ammunition, for instance, and other types of ammunition come from Russia, which might make that a little bit hard to get also if we start doing all these sanctions against Russia. Any concern that you have about any of the trade problems that are going within the United States or going on around the world? I mean, it's just the fact that the trade deficit is so huge here in the United States that we're getting so taken that we have nothing really here to make any money off of. I mean, we're not making any money off of anything other than war and health care for the diseases that people are getting. Any thoughts on that?
Well, as Edwin Starr would no doubt tell us, war, good God, what is it good for? Well, economic benefit. That's the line that a lot of people would say, and that's, of course, why we always look to these types of war situations as perhaps covers for economic collapses and things like that, because they love to try to defer it onto something else. And we've been fed this line about World War II ending the Great Depression for so long that I think a lot of people have just internalized that as kind of, well, that's just how it is. World War II ended the Depression. We obviously don't want a big world war, but hey, if we had one, it would at least improve the economy. I think that's the received wisdom a lot of us have grown up with. And I just recently, just in last week's subscriber newsletter, I wrote about that specifically and debunked that myth, because it is a myth. In fact, it wasn't World War II that ended the Great Depression. It was the end of World War II that ended the Great Depression and the unraveling of the gigantic war bureaucracy that had been created in the 6 years of the World War, and then the 4 years that the U.S. was involved in it. And there was a 61% cutback, 61% reduction. Over one half of the federal government was reduced from 1946 to 1947. About a million federal workers were laid off, and that created one of the biggest booms in American history. I think that is really the tale that, of course, the Keynesians and the people who just want the government to make everything go away by spending more and more don't want you to know about. They don't want you to think about that. They want you to think that it was the war that helped the economy, where, of course, it wasn't. It was not the war. It was the ending of the war and the ending of the war bureaucracy. So that's a really interesting part of all of that. And so I hope that people don't get suckered into that, because, again, it's just one of those subtle ways that they try to program in us that, oh, you know, war's a bad thing, but, you know, it's not bad for the economy, and if you're suffering economically, well, maybe we should go to war. And it's just another insidious part of that war propaganda. Of course, the only people who benefit from war are the military industrial contractors who get the no bid contracts. Those are the people who make the money in times of war.
And the people that benefit in the background, that because of those contracts that are paid off also, and I think we should not fail to mention that. Let's move on to the issue of the Federal Reserve that you wanted to speak about.
Absolutely. Well, I have been, as my regular listeners will know, I've been working on a Federal Reserve documentary for a few months now. So I am very happy to say that it's going to be released this Friday by hook or by crook, whether it's ready or not. And it's going to be a history, an overview of the Federal Reserve, how it works, who's behind it, who owns it, and all of that good stuff. So,
okay, when we get back from this 1 minute, 10 second break, you can tell us about that. 1 minute, 10 second break. We'll be right back. This is Joyce Riley and James Corbett. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. Caring about your world, it's all about the truth. We're talking to James Corbett today. The Federal Reserve is an interest of his, and it will be, the documentary will be out this weekend, and they can see it where, James?
That will be up on my YouTube channel, on corporatereport.com. Hopefully some of my other partner websites will be hosting it. So it will be out there. It won't be hard to find. And it's going to be under the title Century of Enslavement.
Century of Enslavement. And why do you say that to those that may not understand that the Federal Reserve is not our friend?
Well, indeed it isn't. And, of course, we have just passed the centenary of the Federal Reserve Act, which was passed in late December of 1913. So it has been a century now. And enslavement, I know, is perhaps a touchy word. It's obviously one that gets in your face. But I think that what it points to is the fact that really through the monetary system itself and control of that system, the Federal Reserve and the people who own the Federal Reserve literally have control of the entire economy and can control your life to a significant extent from birth to death and everything in between by their power over that fundamental spigot of the money supply. And that's just such a phenomenal, phenomenal thing that it's difficult to even begin to explain how important that is and how overwhelming it is. And that's why I think this requires a feature-length documentary rather than just one of my usual shorter-length podcasts.
Well, there have been a number of documentaries on the Federal Reserve, many, many that are out there. What is different about yours that would interest our listeners to look at it?
Well, I've certainly seen a lot of them myself, and I hope what differentiates mine is that when I put all of these pieces of this puzzle together in my own head, the story of the history of central banking in the United States is an exciting, a dramatic story, and I hope I can convey that in the documentary that I'm about to put out, because we've been taught all our lives that economics is boring, that there's no banking, what could be possibly more boring than banking, when really, if you look at the actual history, this is the beating heart of political activity in the United States for the first couple of centuries of its existence until the Federal Reserve came along, a century and a half late into the existence of the U.S. And kind of after that point, it was all taken out of education and people stopped thinking and talking about it. And it's really just a background type of thing. But it really is just such an important issue. So I hope that this will convey that in a way that makes it apparent to people. And if it doesn't do so, perhaps that's my failure. But at any rate, that's what I'm aiming to accomplish with this, to make it exciting, to make it real to people, to make people understand just how important an issue this has been throughout American history and really history of the globe itself, and just how important it is that we regain and rediscover that history.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the work that you've put into this, and our listeners will appreciate that also. Meanwhile, of course, I don't know if you're aware of this, but CNN is going to be focusing on a new trial this week, which is going to be Oscar Pretorius, the Blade Runner. He allegedly murdered his girlfriend, model. And yet at the same time, we have Osama bin Laden's son-in-law going on trial in New York, and we don't get to see that trial. Don't you think it's interesting the way they choose and pick the trials that we're able to see?
Yes, that is, of course, always one of the main powers that they have had over us for so long, is just choosing what they cover and what they don't, and therefore what exists and what doesn't. But hey, we're here talking about it. We're here, and we have this free and relatively open communication going on, so we can overcome that. And I know that your listeners are committed to that, so hopefully we can break through this. And I really think we are breaking through the propaganda walls that have held people back for so long. So it's an exciting time, because we are here, and we're able to use our minds to counteract the propaganda and the distractions of the mainstream media. So I'm just honored to be here doing that with you, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Well, we appreciate you very, very much. And by the way, in Okinawa, Kadena Air Force Base, they've got the gay military performing there, those that are in the military performing in drag at Kadena Air Base for a fundraiser. Whoa, what a world we live in. Hey, thank you so much, James Corbett. We love having you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Moving on the wall. stand.